This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This is Saturday Magazine.
Our next guest is the RMIT adjunct professor, Peter Norden. Peter Norden is a former Jesuit Catholic priest, has left the priesthood, is now conducting wedding services, and is targeting himself as a same-sex marriage celebrant as well. So it's quite a journey, Peter.
Different franchise.
Quite a journey you've gone through, Peter.
Not exclusively same-sex marriage. I'm available for others as well.
Of course.
But I have got a new little webpage, and we'll mention that maybe. It's been a change, but I did about 1,000 weddings as a Catholic priest over more than 20 years, 25 years.
Wow.
And, now I don't want to do as many. But because every summer I was tied up on Fridays and Saturdays and Sundays, yeah, and wasn't so good. But I do enjoy working with couples and meeting with couples. I've got only one booking at the moment, same-sex marriage. But I only do 5 or 10 a year at the moment, and happy to keep my finger in the pie, so to speak. Hmm.
So what's different? What's different between a religious marriage and a civil marriage? Is that what they're called? Civil marriages?
Yeah, well, in Australia, we don't do what a lot of the world does. Like Europe, they have civil marriage, and then if you want to have some sort of blessing, you go off to your church or your synagogue later and get that. Whereas when I was a priest, I had to sort of stick to the rules of the church. You couldn't marry someone who'd been married before, even if they'd been divorced. You were meant to ask them, are they prepared to have children? I never did. And you were meant to get them to sign a form to say they'd bring their kids up as Catholics, which I think I just ticked that box without asking them, just to fulfil the paperwork.
So you're a bit of a maverick even back then.
Well, I mean, it's a bit ridiculous. Part of the problem with the whole question of same-sex marriage and the church's position is that the Catholic Church in particular focuses, sexuality all about having children. And they don't understand that, for most of us, sexuality and sexual expression is about pleasure. Sometimes it's about building a relationship. And, once or twice in your life, it might be, for some people, wanting to have children. So when you kind of focus the whole theology, as they call it, around sexuality, around, having getting married and having children, it actually doesn't understand the human situation.
Wow. So what's changed in the way in which you conduct a service now? What's different since equal marriage has been made legal?
Well, it was great the last couple of weeks. I've been able not to have to announce the Howard Clause. And so the weddings I've done, a big smile. As we all know, marriage in Australia is the union of two people or two adults, to exclusion of all others. And it's great to have to do that.
So you have to say that?
Oh, you still say that, yeah. But you used to have to say, man and woman to the exclusion of all others, which, for people who are, I remember once marrying a fellow a second time, and sitting in the front row was his son and his male partner, and sitting in the front row was his daughter and a female partner. And I went to them later and I said, look, no disrespect to your relationship. And they said, no, we understand you have to say that by law. So that's changed. Now, I as a civil celebrant, I just follow the couple, whatever they want, and I minimise my involvement. I don't grandstand. I think some civil celebrants, it's their main public function, so they they really make the most of the moment. But for me, the couple have got to be the centre of attention, and so I minimise my involvement and make it a happy celebratory occasion, but I listen to what the couple want.
Sounds great. Mm-hmm. Sounds great. So let's just go back a little bit and talk a bit about your journey, because it is really quite an interesting journey. Mm-hmm. So having gone from being somebody who performs services as a person of faith and a religious order to now no longer being part of that. So what happened?
What happens?
Yeah, what happened? What happened for you?
Oh, for me. Well, I never worked in a kind of a church environment. I did in one sense. I was a Catholic priest, a Jesuit priest, but most of my work was in the non-government community services sector. So I was involved. I'd been the Pentridge chaplain for a long time. I was involved in criminal justice reform, and then in, you know, mental health and drug treatment programs for young people, and then policy at, you know, state and federal level. I was on ACOS council, so I lived in a fairly secular world. I didn't live in a, you know, a secluded churchy world, and so my friends were often, you know, legal advocates. I had worked deeply in the criminal world with the gangland. I did a lot of their funerals and still associate with a number of their families on a social.
But you have left the church.
Yeah, I left the church. So for me, I think the church I joined when I was only 18. It was pretty not an unusual thing for, you know, sort of peer leaders to do at that time. The church was more exciting. It was a going enterprise. But I think the church changed. I mean, it became far more conservative, far more Roman-centric, continued to exclude women. And then, of course, the whole sex abuse scandal. I mean, I left more than 10 years ago, but just that denial was around certainly 10 years ago. So I was partly burnt out, but I was happy with what I'd done for those years, but I didn't want to spend the rest of my life within that institution.
I suppose, Peter, one of the challenges we've seen in the last week, the Pope's tour in Chile, not a universal welcome, churches being bombed, and the issue, a number of issues that people are raising. How do you think moving forward, you know, with child abuse being one of the defining issues that people are so concerned about within the, you know, for Catholics, and we know a lot of, you know, I would think possibly the majority of Catholics in Australia don't necessarily support the church's view on marriage. How do you feel the church moving forward is going to cope with marriage equality being a reality, but particularly in the matters of child abuse? Do you think they're ever going to take the blindfold, the gag and the handcuffs off?
Look, it's hard to know. It's early days. I think that culture takes a long time, and you know, an institution like a Catholic Church, you know, that culture changes over not just years or decades, but sometimes centuries. I said to one of the Royal Commissioners when it first began that, you know, you might make the churches more accountable legally, but you won't change the culture by a report in Australia, because it's based around male celibacy and it's all determined from Rome. I'm pleased that in the recommendations they included a couple of recommendations around celibacy and around our confession, because they were at least sending the message to Rome, as would have happened in Ireland 5 or 10 years before. But I said to one of the Royal Commissioners, look, you know, make it legally accountable, but the culture is determined elsewhere, and it's around male celibacy and effectively the exclusion of women.
I want to ask a question about the sanctity of the confessional and the discussion that, you know, Archbishop Dennis Hart has been at the forefront of. You know, canon law versus state law. I'm going to use measured language here. No, I'm not. It's a fucking disgrace.
You can't use that word on there, Macca.
Because
it doesn't get bleeped out at joint.
No. Here is an institution or institutions that receive money from the state, my money, but everyone else's money, and are given a sacred trust. How can it be that something as heinous as child abuse, something as illegal as child abuse, can be protected, in the church's mind, is protected? Now, granted, there's probably not a lot of cases of this coming up in the confessional. But as an ex-priest yourself, what would have happened if someone had come to you?
Well, first of all, let me say I was absolutely shocked at Archbishop Hart's and Archbishop Fisher's initial response to the Royal Commission. Even if they had dumb PR advisers, they would have at least advised them to be
Well, they've got an ex-general manager of 3AW there.
Yeah, I know.
So they probably do.
But they kind of said no, no, no. And whereas the Pope Francis apparently within a day later he was saying we will examine every recommendation and take them seriously and look at them. So his approach was different, and what's his name in Sydney, Fisher, and Dennis Hart in Melbourne were right out of kilter, and that is a bit of a sign in response to your earlier question about how capable is the church to change. I'm not sure. In one sense, personally, it is a bit of a furphy because, you know, I worked at Pentridge and there were a lot of pedophiles and Catholic pedophiles there. I don't ever recall anyone coming to me with that sort of confession. But I think you've got to take seriously your social responsibility. Now, I hear someone like Frank Brennan being interviewed, and I think he's far more balanced and sane than someone like the Archbishop of Sydney or Melbourne, where he says, you know, you don't automatically give absolution. You tell the person they've got to actually do something about this, which essentially means hand themselves in and so on. Look, it doesn't happen. People don't go to confession in the Catholic Church, haven't for 20, 30 years. Mm. You know, occasionally someone does, but in the old days when we were children, we were lined up every month to go along. You might be reflecting that.
No. I was...
But you knew about it.
A different franchise. I was the Anglican.
But you knew about it, yeah.
I used to see him lining up.
It doesn't happen anymore, but I just think the principle is, I mean, Pope Francis' response was far more constructive and positive than the local archbishops here, let me just say that, but it's not a major issue generally, but symbolically it's a hugely powerful issue, and they were very foolish to not say we have to look at this more carefully.
Because you're right, it actually sets the tenor, it sets the framework, it sets the underlying values behind the practices that occur in parishes right across the nation. Peter, so one of the pieces of work that you've worked on has been a version of Safe Schools type program for Catholic schools. Mm. And from what I understand, a faction within the Catholic school sector called the Edmund Rice Group actually have picked this up and have been running with it. Mm. So we've been familiar with that, but we don't know very much about the program and we haven't been able to engage with that sector yet. So are you able to talk to us a bit about that program?
Oh, yeah, certainly. I did this work back in 2006 when I was at Jesuit Social Services, and it was largely looking at self-harm in schools from drug incidents, and then moved on to GLBTI students. So I ran a consultation around the country at good practice in Catholic schools. Clearly there's some examples of bad practice, but I highlighted good practice and ran it as in-service training for principals all around the country. Last year, Edmund Rice, that runs 53 schools that used to belong to the
all
Christian
in Melbourne?
Brothers, no, all around the country, and they've even got a few in New Zealand, I think, they wanted to update that. They have some very good practice in a couple of their schools, so I updated this old report called Not So Straight into safe and inclusive learning communities for the Edmund Rice. So they're using that for staff training of their 53 colleges all around the country. Essentially based on the awareness, you know, they've got kids in transition at their schools, you know, they're being realistic, they're not head in the sand, but they're also, you know, putting it in the context of anti-bullying, but also the values that school network uses. So it's not just about, you know, the criticism of safe schools, we know what that's been said, but it's about shaping school culture, it's about leadership, it's about staff training, and it's also about how you deal with individuals.
So what makes this particular network of schools different to other Catholic schools?
I think, you know, the independence of the schools, they can do things. They're not directly under the Catholic Education Office. Most of the schools are. They have to fit into Sydney, Melbourne, but they have a network of 53 schools which they're governing. And therefore the primary responsibility for the administration of those schools rests with this governance body, Edmund Rice Education Australia. There's a level of accountability back to Catholic education and, of course, back to the bishops and the leaders. But essentially it's the boards of these schools and the governance of Edmund Rice that can set the tone. And so they're not radical, but they're progressive. You know, they're actually reading the situation and the concerns of the students and their former students, and they realise the world's changing. It's not static. So what they might have been happy with 10 years ago is no longer possible because, as I said, you know, they've got a couple of students in transition at these Catholic secondary schools. They have lots of kids, you know, confused about their identity, or other even younger kids coming out more clearly at the age of 12 or something, which wouldn't have happened perhaps as much anyhow 10 years ago.
Well, for the first time ever in the Western world, people are coming out in their teenage years and earlier.
And supported by their family, but sometimes not. And so within a Catholic milieu, of course, this can be very, very tough if the family, you know, is not accepting and is in denial. And it leads to all sorts of other issues, you know, like running away from home.
I think it's very welcomed and very exciting that we have a set of faith-based schools who have embraced diversity and are working with it. It does appear to be contrary to popular belief, though.
Yes, not many people would be aware of it. But when I did the original study in 2006, I went to 20, 30 schools around the country that were doing really good work. And one of them was one of these schools in Geelong, St. Joseph's. And the headmaster, former headmaster of St. Joseph's, has been influential in shaping the Edmund Rice, Paul Tobias. He's been quoted in The Age a few times, standing up for this issue. But there was good practice. But as I went around the country and ran workshops for principals, I said, how are you allowed to do this? You know, how do you get away with
this? That's my question. I mean, how do they, you know, they obviously receive funding from the church, or they receive, you know, some money from the church. How do they get away with it?
Well, it's about putting it in context, and I, you know, I seriously understood the Catholic value context, and I put it into that context. And, you know, without going into it, but you know, there's a lot of discrimination in the teaching about disordered behaviour and so on, but there's also another aspect of the Church's teaching about respect and compassion. And when you build on that side of it leads to all sorts of positive developments.
Oh, so you used logic.
Yeah, sometimes.
Well, you just have to refer to the Ten Commandments.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's the framework, isn't it? And it's all about love and respect.
Yeah, yeah. These schools are setting a lead, and I'm sure they haven't been negatively responded to by the church leadership, so I think it's a pretty positive establishment. I think you'll find that it depends a lot on the principal and the board of the school as well.
Now, there's a question I always ask when we have people of, well, not just people of faith, but people that have been associated with organisations based on faith. Mm-hmm. Is sexuality God's work?
I would hope it is. I don't know if you're a believer, you would see any part of human behaviour as, you know, the first page in these reports is that we're all born in the image of God, so anything God creates is good.
So we are.
Yeah, for people of faith, they would believe that sexuality is not a nasty thing, a negative thing, but a good thing.
I'm not going to argue with that.
But there's this Jansenistic influence that's been through the church for centuries that talks about, you know, controlling. Pleasure is not seen in many Christian quarters as a good thing. It's something that has to be managed and controlled. So you've got this battle going on in Christian thinking over decades.
What about if I tell them it's not pleasurable?
If it's not pleasurable, it might be more okay.
Yeah. Okay. Tess, it's not pleasurable.
So in other words, you want to have painful sex.
No, I'm just going to say it's not pleasurable. Then I'll be all right.
But I don't get into all this when I'm dealing with couples who are wanting to get married.
No.
No.
I'm a very neutral figure. Not neutral, but I'm a welcoming figure. And if you have a look, you know, I've got a new webpage, samesexmarriage.net.au. .org.au is a group opposed to same marriage equality, so don't get confused with that. But savesexmarriage.net.au actually just simply gives a bit of the emphasis and the values that I would bring when I'm meeting same-sex couples.
Yeah. Did you ever think you'd get to the point, Peter, where you'd be, you know, if we'd said to you 5 years ago, because we some of us thought this was going to be a much longer time coming than it did, that you'd actually be, you know, able to carry out some same-sex marriage.
Oh, yeah,
ceremonies.
I was pretty confident that would happen, but I wasn't aware of the conservative backlash that came up in Australia and so well orchestrated and so well funded. The Australian Christian lobby, you know, not just the Anglican Archbishop, but the Catholics put in millions of dollars, and that hasn't been publicly identified. But no, I was always confident. The movement of, you know, modern nations throughout the world meant that Australia would have to, just moving forward, join that group of countries. And I didn't have any doubt that that would happen sometime in Australia. But I was surprised at the level of conservative backlash which is sweeping the world and which is still operating. The opposition to same-sex marriage that occurred over the last 6 months is now continuing in another entity, and you'll see it operating, you know, maybe supporting Corey Bernardi and company and other groups like that.
But, you know, they ran a campaign, very well funded. But, you know, Graham Richardson, Paul Keating always had a saying, the mob always get it right.
Mm, mm.
And the mob did.
Yeah.
Australians said, you know what, we're not buying into that.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see how, once the inquiry into religious freedom officially starts and what the findings are. My challenge to Malcolm Turnbull is, you believe in religious freedom more than same-sex marriage, mate? Have a postal survey on that.
Yeah.
And I tell you what, you'll be lucky if you get 30% in support of what you say.
Yeah, I think
less than 30%.
The general Australian person knows, you know, at the heart. But as a lot have said, if you can't discriminate against one gay person, how can you discriminate against two?
Yeah.
Exactly. Mm. Exactly. Mm. Peter Norden, thank you very much for your time this morning. It's great to hear your reflections and of your journey as well.
And the website address again is?
Samesexmarriage.net.au.
Saturday Magazine on Joy 94.9, proudly sponsored by Virgin Australia. Visit virginaustralia.com.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.